From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's just 31 words long, but it's one single word ringing out in the Pledge of Allegiance and the ruling of a California court against it that has ignited a stand-up-for-God firestorm across the nation this week. Then the Supreme Court weighed in for the first time in history to send tax dollars to religious schools. This hour, a look at the trembling wall dividing God and government in America. We begin tonight with news of an enigmatic economy. In a week filled with Wall Street wobbles and bad news about corporate corruption, there were also encouraging signs. New numbers from the Commerce Department show the economy grew at a whopping 6.1% in the first 3 months of the year. Greg Ipp is with the Wall Street Journal. Earlier, I asked him if the economy's underlying trend is good or bad.
Surprisingly, Tom, you wouldn't know it to look at what the stock market's been doing lately, but I think the economy is actually doing just fine. We've gone through a bit of a pause in the last month or two, which was kind of understandable given how strong the first quarter was and given how much of that strength was based on temporary things like warm weather and car rebates. But after that pause, there are a lot of signs gathering that, indeed, the economy is starting to gather a bit more strength here. The number of people collecting unemployment insurance has gone down. That suggests there's a bit more job creation going on. The housing market, very strong, record new home sales in May. And finally, still very low interest rates and a lot of stimulus from the federal government in the form of new spending and tax cuts. I would say that in spite of what you're seeing going on in the stock market, the odds are very strongly in favor of continued recovery in the second half of this year.
We saw the reports that came out, I guess, yesterday of a 6.1% rate of growth in the economy in the first quarter. That's extremely high.
That was very high. But a lot of it was driven not by people buying new things or businesses going out there and investing in new buildings and equipment, but merely from the fact that businesses were not filling as much of their sales out of inventories as they had been in prior months. As you may recall, over the period of the recession, businesses were so gloomy, they were just shutting down assembly lines and saying, I'm just going to, if I get new orders in, I'm just going to like take it off the shelves in the warehouses and fill my orders that way. And so, of course, even though you had some sales going on, production kept going down. That turned around in the first quarter. Companies stopped filling all their stuff out of inventories. That produced a lot of that boost. But inventories can only produce a temporary sort of boost to production. We really need a follow-through from consumer spending and business spending. Consumers still seem to be hanging in there. Businesses are still very gloomy, but we keep seeing little signs here and there, small to be sure, but encouraging that indeed business investment is slowly coming back.
And Greg, if overall, what kind of recovery is this? Is it following a typical pattern? Is it true to the standard form, if there is such a thing, for economic recovery?
No, Tom, I think it's obvious that this is proving to be a much softer recovery than typical, and I think that's for several reasons. Number one, the recession was fairly mild, so the basic rule is that the less ground you lose, the less you have to make up on the upside. But also, there are a couple of restraints still acting on the economy. People have lost trillions of dollars in stock wealth in the last few years. That's continuing to pinch their pocketbooks. Also, there was an extraordinary overbuilding of a lot of types of investment in the late 90s, especially in the telecommunications area, as WorldCom's problems, even before this week, were ample evidence of. And that continues to weigh on the economy. With that excess of capital stock out there, businesses have less incentive to invest. So you have a couple of special headwinds acting against the economy right now, and that's one reason we aren't predicting the really blistering rates of growth in the next year or two, which you often do have coming out of a recession.
And what about the uncertainty around the stock market? If it stays stagnant at this level or goes down or only goes up a little bit, how much headwind does this give the overall economy? Can the economy come back strong if the market doesn't?
Short answer, yes. The economy can come back strong if the market doesn't. And indeed, I think that would be the commonest forecast of most of the prognosticators out there. And that's for several reasons. Number one, even though a lot of people are hurting over how badly their 401ks and their mutual funds are doing, the average family has a lot more wealth tied up in their house than it does in their stock portfolio. And house prices, as you probably know, have continued to be very strong in all the way through the recession and into this year. Another reason is that the stock market really began to lose altitude early in 2000. So this has been with us for a while. I mean, we've lost, sure, another, 10% in the last month or two. But you tack that onto the 20 or 30% we'd already lost, you got to feel that most of the bad news is already in the behavior of individuals out there. So for those reasons, I think that, yes, you can continue to have a reasonably decent recovery even if the stock market remains soft. That said, if it goes down further, if we continue to have more of the confidence-shaking type events that we had, like we had this week, I would say all bets are off. I mean, for one thing, businesses who are worrying about whether there's going to be a blow-up on their books or worrying about what their stock price is doing aren't going to be in a terribly good mood to embark on any new expansion plans.
That's going to keep them quiet, not buying, not spending money themselves. And what about the pullout of foreign capital, Greg? We hear that a lot of money is leaving Wall Street, heading back to Europe, back to Asia. What's the impact?
There's no question, if you look at the fact that the dollar is now down some 10%, I guess, since its peak in March, that foreigners have definitely turned bearish on the U.S. situation. The impact is going to be mixed. It will tend to make it harder for businesses here to raise capital. That could put some upward pressure on interest rates. It's going to certainly keep the stock market in the doldrums. But it will have the other positive impact of finally giving a bit of relief to the manufacturers here in the United States who've been complaining about how the strong dollar for years has put them in a negative competitive position vis-a-vis their European and Asian competitors. So there is an offset there. So it's not clear at this point whether that's a net positive or a net negative.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from Washington. Three California judges got a stiff lesson in national sentiment this week when they took aim at "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance in public schools and, quote, "impermissible government endorsement of religion," wrote Judge Goodwin of the Ninth Circuit Court. But America was having none of that. The airwaves exploded with denunciations of anything, anywhere that came between God and country. Then the Supreme Court swung its gavel in favor of God and government when it ruled yesterday to allow public tax money to support religious schools. But the court's minority opinion sounded a somber warning. Don't let public dollars work their way between the bricks that separate church and state, they said. The Constitution built that wall for a reason. But does America still believe in the wall between church and state? Do we need God too much for the government to hold the Almighty at arm's length? Should tax dollars be used to teach kids the Torah, the Bible, the Quran? Is American spirituality finding the right relationship with the American state? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Charles Haynes. He's a senior scholar at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center and author of Finding Common Ground, A Guide to Religious Liberty in Public Schools. Good evening and welcome, Charles Haynes.
Thanks for having me.
Charles Haynes, it feels to our ear like a pretty significant week on the God and government front. The first news was actually pushing back against "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance, but then came the tremendous backlash against that, and right on its heels, the Supreme Court saying, indirectly but nevertheless, public tax dollars can and now will go to religious education. Is this an important week in your mind?
Oh, it's probably the most important week in a very long time for all kinds of reasons. But I think at the end, when all the dust settles, the First Amendment's still in pretty good shape and religious liberty experiment in America will survive. But I think that there are some warning signs in this week that we need to attend to the First Amendment and be careful.
What's going on here? Behind these two steps, do we have a shifting American attitude toward the relationship between God and government somehow?
I think the "under God" reaction really is an old American story. You know, every time we're in a crisis in the United States, we sort of turn back to asking our nation to acknowledge that we're somehow under God, connecting God and country. That's, you know, after the Civil War, we put "In God We Trust" on our money. And during the Cold War, we added these two words to the pledge that are now in contention, under God. Mm-hmm. And in the fall of this year, after the war on terrorism began, many legislators around the country started reinstituting the pledge in our public schools. I think that's really an old theme, and this idea of being under God resonates with the American people really throughout our history, and times of crisis really accentuate that emotion and bring it out, and I think it'll die down after this decision is overruled, which it certainly will be, but I think it does tell us something about where we are as a people. Some of the messages aren't so good.
Give us those messages, and how do you interpret them?
I think that one of the things is that, you know, our politicians, instead of helping the American people to understand how our legal system works, helping them to understand how important it is to protect the right to dissent. This poor fellow in California who filed this lawsuit's been getting death threats. And instead of doing all of that and calming people down and explaining what's at stake, they get on the steps of the Capitol and say the pledge in unison, and they call the decision nuts and ridiculous. And I think that kind of overreaction to two judges out of three in California or the Ninth Circuit is not good for the country. It doesn't really make this a teachable moment. This is a time when we need to look at how we work these things out in our legal system. So that doesn't say good things. There's a kind of jingoism in the air, flag waving. But I think people have to remember what the flag stands for. And two of the most important principles the flag stands for are freedom of conscience, which this man in California was exercising. Mm-hmm. As a non-believer, he was exercising his right of conscience to dissent and the right to dissent. Now, I don't say that he should win or that the court got it right. I think, in fact, they got it wrong. But I do think that we need to have a dialogue in this country about how we can treat everyone with fairness and respect, including non-believers, and there are a growing number of those in this country.
The response from the political world was certainly white-hot. President Bush called the ruling ridiculous. California Gray Davis may have been the closest. He called it wrong-headed, but said it's the wrong decision at the worst possible time. I think he surely got that right.
He got that right.
Tom DeLay called it absurd, a court run amok. The Congress is not going to let anyone strip our nation of our proud heritage, not now, not ever. Joe Lieberman, there may have been a more senseless, ridiculous decision issued by a court at some time, but I don't remember it. I mean, people just jumped on this with both feet. As you say, it might have been a teachable moment about the roots of this constitutional separation of church and state, but you didn't hear much of that talk in the air. Is this, when you look back across history, is this level of ferocity in rallying around the God word and around religion, is it typical for American politicians?
Well, yes, God wins votes. And I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, but I'm afraid it's true. People use God in public life to win votes. They've been doing it with the prayer debate for more than 40 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Supreme Court, when it struck down state-sponsored prayer and Bible reading in public schools in the early 60s, there was a similar kind of reaction, even more than this, and it was more sustained because that was the Supreme Court. This decision by a three-panel appellate court doesn't have nearly the significance, and it will doubtlessly be overruled. But when the Supreme Court spoke, the whole nation was in uproar. Instead of really looking at what the decision said, in fact, students weren't told they couldn't pray in public school. Mm. The Supreme Court's never ruled against prayer, but politicians used that ruling to argue that God had been kicked out of the schools. And some religious leaders and politicians to this day continue to misrepresent what the Supreme Court was trying to do in the 1960s. Hmm. So, you know, it's sad because I think Americans, particularly religious Americans who feel deeply about this issue, forget that separating church from state, the disestablishment of religion in America, has been in the best interest of religion. It's really made religion strong in America, and unlike everywhere else in the world, it's enabled us to live with deep religious differences and still build one nation.
And now that public tax dollars will, if through parents, and therefore the Supreme Court says indirectly, but nevertheless, will flow to religious schools, do you think, Charles Haynes, that will make religion stronger in the country or not?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think the next battle in the voucher debate will be in the legislatures. It'll be a public policy battle. And I think that it's going to be really a tough row to hoe for the voucher proponents still, because lots of people don't like vouchers and like their public schools. So I'm not sure that this decision will inevitably mean lots of voucher programs out there. But even if it does, I don't think the sky is falling. I think that the court, even though I think it has changed the rules under the No Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, no question about that. But I don't think that the court is ready to say that money should go to support religion. Now, of course, people who disagree with this decision and the dissenters on the court say, well, that's exactly what's happening.
Well, and of course, there will be religious instruction in those schools. We'll come back and talk more about it. We're talking with Charles Haynes at the Freedom Forum. The issue tonight is America and God, church, state, and the God debate. How do you see America's public relationship with God? Too hot, too cold, or just right? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
from
Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America and God, about church, state, and the God debate. It's been a big week. President Bush called the California court's objection to under God and the Pledge of Allegiance ridiculous. Do you agree? Is the country moving away from separation of church and state? And in a time of terror, have we become a nation of foxhole believers? What are the implications if we have? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Charles Haynes. He's a senior scholar at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center. And now by William Van Alstyne. He's constitutional law professor at Duke University Law School. He's author of the foundational law school textbook, The American First Amendment in the 21st Century. Good evening and welcome, Professor William Van Alstyne.
Thank you. It's good to join you.
Thanks for being with us. Professor Van Alstyne, take us back, if you would, because there's been a lot of reference to the founders in recent days and their intentions and their relationship and understanding of God and the role, the relationship of religion and state. Take us back to the founders, their understanding of religion and how it ought to intersect with the American state.
I'm pleased to do that. There's quite a bit of misunderstanding. The founders were operating against a background of preferred religions and the fusion of church and state in Europe, mm-hmm. not dissimilar to what we've now seen in some of the Middle Eastern states. And so I quite agree with Mr. Haynes, whose last remarks I caught, that they thought it a good idea to encourage the flourishing of diverse religions with maximum freedom for each, and to keep the state's hands off of the churches and simultaneously discourage the churches from attempting to borrow from the public fisc. And we've gradually moved away from that. There are only two clauses in the Constitution, incidentally, that are addressed to religion.
Mm-hmm.
That is in the First Amendment, that's most familiar with people, that forbids laws respecting an establishment of religion and at the same time forbidding laws that prohibit the free exercise of religion. There's an earlier clause that many people don't remember, and that's in the original Constitution, that provides that there shall never be any religious test as a qualification for any office under the authority of the United States. And I want to start with that in this very brief review just because that's startling for some. It meant what it said, that there could be no test of even religiousness, never mind a preferred religion.
Mm-hmm. So whatever God one might worship or whether one
or
worship no God at all.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's not widely understood, for instance, that most of the little religious additions that public officials have added were gratuitous. When one takes an oath of office, even as president under the Constitution, the oath is prescribed by the Constitution, is simple and direct, to support and defend the Constitution of the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Mm-hmm.
George Washington, as a private matter, added the words, "So help me God." But they're really not a part of the required oath, nor its official part. And what has happened over the years is that public officials, partly from sincerity, but often from political convenience, have added in these incidents of piousness, and so they've crept in gradually. I'll give you just two or three quick examples.
Please.
Because each by itself is really quite innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So I do understand the sense of kind of rebuke or shock that's come in from the Ninth Circuit. The original motto of this country was a great Latin motto. It was E Pluribus Unum. Find it on a few coins. Mm-hmm. It's largely disappeared. But it was a great motto, and it meant one from many.
Mm-hmm.
One solid nation from a diversity of states and of people. It has been replaced in 1954 by Act of Congress by substituting In God We Trust.
The same year that Under God was inserted in the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's right. It was done simultaneously and, frankly, for a political and largely propagandistic objective. In the heat of the Cold War, encouraged by John Foster Dulles, a very religious man,
mm-hmm.
and supported by Eisenhower, Congress was readily persuaded to try to relocate the country from a civil polity of equal people with a generous freedom of religion to a new country that could claim to be specially under the sanction of God, and therefore, you see, somehow better than and different from the godless atheist communists of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, many religious people, though it may not now be remembered, honestly objected to that because they recognized that when the civil state begins to appropriate the signs of authentic religion, it takes them outside the community of the faith and applies them to secular or political ends, and to that extent begins to degrade religion by kind of trading upon its popularity, as it were. And we see that in other countries now. I mean, countries reorganizing themselves and even claiming an almost fanatical exclusive correctness in the manner in which they administer things, always under God, under Allah, or under some other stewardship. Now, our encroachments are much more modest, but they are just by slight degrees.
Of course, much more modest, but starting from a very different place, the U.S. Constitution, which was a radical document in its time. William Van Alstyne, you describe politicians using reference to God, perhaps for, other than holy reasons,
yeah.
And this kind of slow accretion of language and religious reference that's come into public life. When you add all that up, do you see, when you look across time, the United States having fundamentally shifted its relationship of God and government, God and state, or are we pretty much on an even keel that we've held over centuries?
Well, I'm not an alarmist about this, and particularly not disturbed if the Ninth Circuit is reversed. But at the national level, we've moved toward a kind of community of national piousness of an indiscriminate sort. That is to say, we haven't elected Christianity outright. But we have gone a considerable distance in that direction. The answer is a little more complicated because the great concern of the First Amendment, as you can tell, again, just by looking at the language and not even thinking further, was with the national government and what it might presume to do. So the restriction was on Congress, not on the states. And in the beginning, the states went their very different ways. Massachusetts in the Northeast, for instance, still subsidized exclusively Protestant churches to the exclusion of others.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time in Virginia, Madison and Jefferson had already succeeded in disestablishing favored churches. And indeed, the First Amendment owes more to the Virginians in the separation of church and state at the national level than any part of the country.
Mm-hmm. Charles Haynes, I want to bring you in. Have the schools always been the primary battleground for the church-state line?
Yes, I think since the founding of schools, we've been fighting about the role of religion in the public schools. And, of course, in the 19th century, we had a semi-established Protestant nation, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to talk about movement, we certainly moved away from that.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the 20th century, we have what Robert Handy used to call the second disestablishment. Because of religious pluralism and growing secularism in our society, we really just, the Protestant consensus of the 19th century broke apart, including in public schools. We had vestiges, devotional Bible reading in the morning without comment, a prayer to whom it may concern prayer in the morning. It didn't mean much, but there it was. And the Supreme Court finally began to be consistent about this and applied the First Amendment to the states and said, look, public schools are not places where we impose religion, even general religion, general Protestantism, on our kids. So I think we have moved in that direction to really, especially during that period, to say, look, public schools need to be places where everyone is treated with fairness and respect. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think that the Supreme Court's decisions pushed the pendulum too far the other way, and many schools began to create, instead of a sacred public school, a kind of naked public school,
mm-hmm.
or religion-free zones,
mm-hmm.
where religion was supposed to be kept out. So textbooks didn't talk about religion, and kids were told they couldn't bring their Bible to school and so forth. Now, I think, in the past decade, we've gotten back to I think, what the First Amendment's really all about. We've gotten consensus that there are many ways in which kids can express their religious faith in a public school. We've agreed on that, right to left. We have guidelines on that now. And we should be teaching about religion in the curriculum. So this is a new vision for the First Amendment in public schools. And the reason that's still awkward and people aren't doing it everywhere and there's no real understanding of it in the country is because it's new.
But, of course, teaching about religion is different than teaching religion.
Absolutely. That would be
unconstitutional. As in inculcating religion, and I guess that's what the Supreme Court would decision this week would effectively send public tax dollars off one way or another to do. Charles Haynes, William Van Alstyne, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. The question is, are we drifting away from the founder's vision of God and the public life or not? And if we're drifting, in what direction are we drifting? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about whether or not we actually have had separation, anything like a separation of church and state, for a long time. It seems to me that the government by giving tax breaks to religions and by being in the business of deciding what is and isn't a religion so that they can decide who does get a tax break and who doesn't, the government has been subsidizing religions for decades.
How so, Chris?
Well, if I set up an organization and by default I pay taxes, I have to do something special to get out of paying taxes. So the government has to decide whether or not they're going to allow me to not pay taxes.
You mean because religious organizations are tax exempt?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a good point. Could I turn in and offer a qualification
sure.
of that view?
Yes, William Van Alstyne, please.
He's got an excellent point, but it's also one of contrast in two steps.
Mm-hmm.
Tax exemption does free voluntary communities of faith from having to contribute to their church beyond the means of support of the church. That
yes.
is to say, the church can then use their free will offerings
mm-hmm.
for religious purposes only. But so they are exempt from the property tax, for instance, and exempt from the standard income tax. But in that regard, frankly, then they are left alone and treated very much the same as other nonprofit entities. For instance, one may have a non-religious, non-profit
mm-hmm.
educational organization,
mm-hmm.
and it's really treated the same way. Now, when we move to the school voucher situation, however, there really is a seismic shift, because this is not an effort to try to leave the churches to raise such funds from those members of the faith who support that ideology.
And William Van Alstyne, you mean a seismic shift this week in the Supreme Court ruling?
I do indeed.
And what is that shift exactly in your mind?
The seismic shift is then now persons are paying taxes that are then paid over to people, parents to be sure,
mm-hmm.
to be spent as chits to immerse their children in the exclusivity of a given faith. In short, tax funds are flowing affirmatively to various churches that may then use them for emphatic sectarian religious purposes.
And how big a deal is this?
Well, it's a very big deal, and that's why it's not only divided the court 5-4, but I've just finished editing the various opinions, and they run to a breathtaking 170 pages. The degree of dismay within the court on the one hand and in conviction on the other is really quite titanic. This is the decision of the year from the Supreme Court.
Justice John Paul Stevens called the decision profoundly misguided. He said, admittedly, in reaching that conclusion, I have been influenced by my understanding of the impact of religious strife on the decisions
yes.
of our forebears to migrate to this continent and
yes.
on the decisions of neighbors in the Balkans, Northern Islands, and the Middle East to mistrust one another. Whenever we remove a brick from the wall that was designed to separate religion and government, we increase the risk of religious strife and weaken the foundation of our democracy. Those are pretty strong words.
They are. Well, and again, this is a difficult area, but for your listeners and for Mr. Haynes, too, and everyone, let me suggest what Stevens has in mind. The flourishing of religion is, in fact, encouraged by their tax-exempt status in connection with
mm-hmm.
other nonprofit organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, persons may even deduct in advance from what taxes they might otherwise owe, contributions
yes.
they make to their churches and to the church schools as such. And that's true with other nonprofit charitable entities. Now, when we get, however, to the use of tax funds affirmatively supplied to equip them, we are going to get new divisions of the following sort, and these are sharply reviewed in the opinion by Justice Souter, and that is the following. One of the conditions for the eligibility of a participating school, of course, is that, quote, they don't discriminate. And that means then they must not even give preference in admission to those who share their common faith.
Mm-hmm.
It also means that they may be in difficulty if they continue to preach within the parochial school the true faith, which is the basis for the founding of the school.
That is, a religious school that accepts this voucher money can no longer inculcate its pupils with that faith?
That would be so if, for instance, the faith taught by way of example, and many religions do, ultra-Orthodox
mm-hmm.
Jewish groups do, and some fundamentalist Christian groups do,
mm-hmm.
and some Islamic faiths teach that only those who are members of this faith are within the protection of God and have any assurance of going to heaven. In short, their very faith treats other people as not of the same status. It is a variety of what you would call discriminatory speech. It makes children who don't share that faith
mm-hmm.
but who will be attending that school feel less welcome.
Charles Haynes, several of the courts...
There will be policy conflicts as to whether or not these schools must be delisted for eligibility.
And that those will be hot conflicts. Charles Haynes, several of the dissenting judges expressed concern that this step may drive Americans into religious categories, further separate and drive apart Americans of different religions. What do you think?
Well, that may be the case. There's enough Thomas Jefferson and Roger Williams in me to worry about this decision. But let me just remind your listeners mm-hmm. that the five justices, the majority, and when in the Supreme Court, you only need to count to five, mm-hmm. They're saying really something they've been saying the court has been moving toward for a long time. They're saying, we want to think about equal treatment under the Establishment Clause. So, you know, we've long understood that if someone gets a grant to go to college from the government and he decides to take it to a school that's religiously affiliated, he may do so. If all kinds of universities are applying for funds to build dormitories, then Notre Dame can apply also. Mm-hmm. That kind of principle that we're familiar with.
So the kind of neutrality toward religion.
A neutrality, equal treatment philosophy. Now, when it comes to schools, of course, that's trickier. We're dealing with young, impressionable kids. And when the choices are mostly in Cleveland, you go, if you get your voucher, you're going to go to a religious school because that's about the only choice you have mm-hmm. other than the public school. Mm-hmm. That raises serious questions, and the court struggled with that. But the movement in the court, like it or not, has been towards how do we get the government to be truly neutral about religion. Now, having said that, I understand that people don't think this is going to be neutral, but it's important that we understand the court is not there are some members of the court mm-hmm. who might take us further and want direct aid to religion, but I think the majority of the court understands that the First Amendment forbids direct aid to religion or government support for religious proselytizing and worship and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's a very important principle. Mm. It perhaps has been eroded here. We'll see. But I think that, you know, Justice O'Connor has made it clear that she doesn't think it has. And I would hope not. I'm worried about it. But I think that that's what your listeners have to understand. That's where the court's moving.
That's where they are. William Van Alstyne, we just have 30 seconds
sure.
before the break. But do you see this decision putting the government in a position of neutrality toward religion?
No, I really don't. Many of the other programs did live up to that ambition, even though they indirectly helped the school. And let me give you contrasting examples. To the extent that taxes pay for a common vaccination program, the fact then that medical personnel may also attend the various parochial schools in the area and have those children vaccinated mm-hmm. obviously helps them in that school. You may have other examples very much in terms of even sending in personnel to provide remedial courses in reading.
William Van Alstyne, please hold the thought. We have to take a short break. I'm sorry to interrupt. We're talking about America and God, about church, state, and the God debate. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Is the God in God We Trust your God? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about America and God, about church, state, and the God debate tonight. Our guests are Charles Haynes, senior scholar at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center and author of Finding Common Ground, A Guide to Religious Liberty in Public Schools, and Professor William Van Alstyne, constitutional law professor at Duke University Law School. Question is the country moving away from separation of church and state? And what if it's not pleated skirts and Bibles that vouchers support? What if it's headscarves and Qurans? Do you still support government funding of religious education? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim is on the line. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
Hey there. Hi. It's a great show, by the way.
Thank you.
I just have two really quick points.
Mm-hmm.
The first is about the mental block. The Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay, we all know that one.
Okay, right. Basically, as far as that goes, it's very much a valid discussion, and I'm very liberal, and I understand exactly why it does kind of erode the original intent of the Constitution.
Does it bother you having under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, Jim?
No, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why I think there's an outcry. I think what you're really seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
is what you might call political correctness fatigue. And I'm liberal, okay?
But you're saying the judges in California just took it to such a degree that the country said enough already.
Yeah, there's been a lot of pushing. I'm not saying the country has really moved that far to the left in the last 20 years, but there's been a lot of pushing since the 1960s on a variety of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that these points are illegitimate, but it's almost human nature. There is a general geist, a general sense of fatigue with political correctness. And I'm someone who actually is, like I said, liberal. My prediction is that the same issue, once some of these frustrations with political correctness tend to burn themselves out over the next 10 to 15, maybe 20 years,
mm-hmm.
I think the same issue will resurface, and a nation in a different mood would probably have no problem taking the word God out of that. But I think at the moment, liberals and people on the left need to focus more and try to better understand this fatigue with political correctness,
mm-hmm.
because it's a very strong thing out there. It's felt in the workplace. It's felt in the schools. People complain about it all the time. And understanding what that is a very important part of advancing or reclaiming things like this particular issue.
I think you're clearly onto something there,
really,
Jim.
Well,
thank you for your call. Charles Haynes, you feel the pendulum swinging?
I agree with that, if I may.
Charles Haynes, first, please.
Let me just make a comment, mm-hmm. and say this, that a couple of things. I think that there has been, over the past several decades, there has been a sense in the country, rightly or wrongly, among many religious people,
mm-hmm.
that religion has been kept out of the public square, religion has been taken out of the schools and so forth. I think a lot of that is exaggerated, but there are examples of that. And I think that the caller is touched on that, and that's an important point. There is a kind of backlash. I think even people who are nominally religious feel comfortable with this ceremonial deism that's part of the warp and woof of American life and has been for a very long time. And that was my other point. When we talk about original intent, I think one has to be careful, because the framers and the founders had different views on this.
Quite right.
After all, the first Congress did, in fact, vote to have a chaplain and begin each session with prayer, and the Supreme Court has upheld that practice as constitutional, which
mm-hmm.
is pretty, you know, inconsistent with a lot of other rulings, but there we are. It's not all pretty and consistent. It's a little messy, and it's because we have different views of this. I mean, I think at the heart of the matter is, can we sustain the principle of religious liberty and protect the rights of all, keep the government basically out of religion, and that, I think, is our vision. Around the edges, there are going to be these exceptions. There are going to be these incursions. If they don't rise to the level of great harm and government really getting involved in religion deeply, I'm not so concerned about them. But I think we have to watch and
mm-hmm.
be careful.
William Van Alstyne, your sense is this in part the country saying, look, we've had enough of political correctness and being told where God belongs and where God doesn't belong?
I think your caller has it exactly right. And in the good sense of his practical observation, helps also to forecast why the three-judge panel is almost certain to be overturned, although
mm-hmm.
it's difficult. And I want to share, I hope, his optimism that after things settle down, perhaps the point that was sought to be made by the parent who sued for their child
mm-hmm.
will be appreciated a little bit more. I want to say also a sympathetic word to the problems that the judiciary has. It's perfectly understandable that the public, particularly encouraged by the president, reacts so strongly to some of these decisions from the court.
Mm-hmm.
But you must understand, they don't volunteer for this. So this is a parent of a small child who feels a stranger in the same school when every day at the beginning of the day there is this effort, even in the public school system. It's a slight thing compared with what took place in the 19th century, and I agree with Mr. Haynes in that regard. But it's the same routine. That person files suit. They then ask the court to determine whether or not this particular activity does or does not meet the standards of the First Amendment.
And there's a lonely moment for that court.
That's right. And so it's a really trembling dilemma. I don't think these judges are naive about what the public reaction is likely to be like. In fact, the day's news today indicate they've already put a stay order on their own judgment so that it can be reviewed again by the full panel, and it probably will be reversed.
But what a subtle...
But it's a dilemma in the sense that they can either kind of wink,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps they should, and let this one pass as well because it's very marginal and because there is this sense that the courts have gotten too much involved, or they can kind of swallow hard and say, this litigant has presented a claim, and we can't deny the merit that it has, so that even if there is an expected backlash, and even if every member in Congress troops to the well to denounce it...
Mm-hmm. Here's how we read the Constitution of this country.
That's right. So I do want to suggest that These judges on the prevailing side were respectively appointed, to be sure, one by President Carter, the other, interestingly enough, by Richard Nixon.
Going way back.
That's quite right. Mm. So if you put it in that setting, I think we'll be less inclined. And I want to share Mr. Haynes' observations, too. The founding of Catholic schools in this country was partly by way of genuinely poignant reaction to the pervasiveness of Protestantism pervading the public.
They needed a refuge or a place to bolster
they
themselves.
Did. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so we now have new refugees that have come into the United States in mm-hmm. large numbers, mm-hmm. drawn by the notion that this was a civil state that would be equally respectful, at least in the public sector.
But what
and
an irony now.
The voucher decision is so important is because the voucher decision is a response. And I've been telling public schools this for years. This is coming down the track. Get ready and do the best you can to deal with religious liberty in ways that are fair and respectful of everyone, because many religious people today, many Protestants, ironically, feel much like Catholics did in the 19th century, rightly or wrongly. I think often they exaggerate the problem. They do feel, particularly evangelicals, often that public schools are hostile to their faith. They want alternatives. They want out. Most Muslim parents I talk to around the country, for example, also say, you know, if I had the choice, I would rather send my kid somewhere else. Public schools don't reflect my values. They're hostile to our faith. Mm. I think that's overblown. I think public schools are actually doing a better job in dealing with religion in recent years.
Charles Haynes, I've got to come in here. We've got one more caller I want to bring in, and it's at a moment when this irony that we have our magazines full of photographs of religious schools in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Middle East, and we scratch our heads and say, how can they do that?
Indeed.
We're joined now by Rob Boston. He's with Americans United for the Separation Between Church and State. Good evening and welcome, Rob Boston.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Our time has run short, but look at this week's events, particularly the vouchers for religious schools, and what is your group thinking and saying, Rob?
Well, it certainly has been a busy week, I'll tell you that. We obviously were displeased with the voucher ruling. We have historically opposed all forms of government funding of religion. I did not find the reasoning by the majority or Justice O'Connor to be particularly persuasive in the Zelman case, and obviously we're going to be working on that in other ways in the legislatures. We'll be looking at possible mm-hmm. litigation under the state constitutions. The other case coming out of the Ninth Circuit was quite a surprise. I share the view of the others on the panel that it will probably be overturned. And to tell you the truth, although I think that the based on strict reasoning, the court may be right, I find it something of a distraction. The voucher case is much more serious, mm-hmm. has the potential to really change a lot of things in this country, education, religious liberty. And I'd like to see more discussion and talk about that rather than have this really visceral, emotional debate over the Pledge of Allegiance right now, which, quite frankly, here in Washington has been open to much demagoguery.
Well, and clearly the bigger long-term debate is going to be over vouchers. Rob Boston, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
William Van Alstyne, our caller earlier, as you noted, suggested that the pendulum will swing again, that Americans will loosen up their grip on religion and perhaps become less interested in seeing government and God hitched together. Yet we see examples throughout history and all over the world where that's not true today. What's your level of confidence that the pendulum will swing the other way?
I'm fundamentally very optimistic about the resilience of this country, partly because of the comparison that I would want to make that has not been made to our freedom of speech in this country. Because of the court's very courageous stewardship of the First Amendment, we have had a breadth of freedom of expression, of extreme views, that is rivaled by no other country in the entire world. Mm-hmm. And I think it's partly the glory of this country that we do that. And so when we reach common ground and elect people and adopt policies, at least it's been under conditions of almost maximum freedom. I think people will come to appreciate the diversity we have also of religions in this country. And as they gradually strengthen, we will respect them more as private voluntary entities. I want to close with the point I was trying to make earlier. Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, our laws do, in fact, encourage religions to flourish, and they do that in such a variety of ways, in safeguarding the churches, in providing mm-hmm. them exemption with other nonprofits, in providing deductibility for charitable contributions, in securing their freedom to go from door to door and to proselytize in ways that are disallowed otherwise. We turn a fateful corner that I hope we will reverse, however, when we provide various religions incentives to lobby to participate from public tax funds to support their profoundly sectarian religious missions.
William Van Alstyne, with that,
we will end by forbidding certain religions to qualify for their religious schools for those vouchers.
And we're going to have to leave it there tonight, William Van Alstyne, but I thank you for your point and for joining us. William Van Alstyne is constitutional law professor at Duke University. And Charles Haynes, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Charles Haynes is senior scholar at the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, kids speak out about the Pledge of Allegiance controversy. This is On Point. In tonight's radio diary, young people share their own thoughts on the inclusion of religion in the Pledge of Allegiance. In the process, some of them question the relevancy and meaning of the oath itself.
My name is Sarah Kennedy, and I'm 14. I'm pretty sure I believe in God, but I don't think that a reference to God should be put into the Pledge of Allegiance, because we're pledging allegiance to our country, not to God. And separation of church and state, it should be complete and not just at certain times. Like, kids aren't allowed to pray in school, but we have to say under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, which we're required to say in school.
My name's Kyle, and I'm 12. I think it's pointless to even have the Pledge of Allegiance because no one even cares about it. Like, no one's, like, actually gets serious about it or anything. My teacher makes us say it every day, but most of the kids don't even, like, stand up or say it or anything. Most people just, like, listen to it and kind of, like, mumble it and, like, eat their snack. Even if they took out the God part, it still wouldn't, like, make a difference in how people, like, looked at it or anything. Everyone would just still, like, not pay attention to it. I really think it could say anything at all in that spot. Like, it could be, like, under the New England Patriots. And still, people would just be, like, people wouldn't care. People would just be, like, under the New England Patriots or, like, under, like, Bill Clinton or something. And still, people wouldn't, like, care about it.
My name is Claire Higgins, and I'm 14 years old.
I have a friend who a lot of her friends got really angry with her because she did not believe in God, and they thought she was being disrespectful. So when the Pledge of Allegiance, she most likely feels uncomfortable saying under God, but if she didn't, you know, her friends might get mad at her. I'm pretty sure she just mouths it but doesn't say it. But she still feels really uncomfortable saying it.
Sarah Kennedy, Claire Higgins, and Kyle McGuire live in Milton, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.